by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Cotton Cloud Futons, a locally owned business featuring futons and mattresses, frames, covers, furnishings, and accessories which can be made with organic and recycled materials. Cotton Cloud is located at 701 Northeast Broadway in Portland. Information at 503-335-0758 or cottoncloudfutons.com.
Show today. I think our topic will be sort of about the future, and we'll be focusing on peak oil. Later on, we'll be talking with Richard Heinberg, who is the author of The Party's Over, and then a book called Power Down, Options and Actions for a Post-Carbon World. Since we're talking about peak oil, let me remind our listeners that there is a Portland Peak Oil Group, and they meet every Wednesday at 7 p.m., and they meet in the dining hall of St. Francis Church, which is not far from KABU. It's 1182 Southeast Pine Street, so that's on Pine between 11th and 12th. And it's, tonight there'll be the monthly general meeting with small group discussions. So that's tonight, as every Wednesday at 7 p.m. at St. Francis Church. Got this thing in my email, you know, I looked up in my files. This is a report from, 3 years ago. The Global Environment Outlook, and was compiled for the UN, and it, a forecast by 1,100 scientists and how they thought the world would look in the year 2032. So while we're going through this, the number to call here is 231-8187. What do you people out there think? What do you think Portland will be like in the year 2032? But this is what the scientists think the world will look like. They say more than half the world will be afflicted by water shortages, with 95% of the people in the Middle East with severe problems and 65% in the rest of Asia and the Pacific. The Mediterranean coast will come under special pressure through urban growth, inadequate wastewater treatment, tourism, and intensively farmed crops. But the report says it need not be like that. In richer countries, water and air pollution is down. Species have been restored to the wild, and forests are increasing in size. So, in other words, it can be done. All it takes is the money and the effort to do it. So this is sort of a summary of the bad news. In 30 years from the time of the report, 70% of the Earth's surface will be suffering severe impact of human activities, destroying the natural world with roads, mining, and cities. 1,183 species of birds, around 12% of the world's total, and 1,130 species of mammals, about a quarter, are threatened with extinction. One-third of the world's fish stocks are depleted or overexploited. Concentrations of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere could double by 2050. The number of people affected by weather-related disasters has risen from 147 million a year to 211 million in 10 years. Now, keep in mind that this report was out in the year 2002, and now we have seen hurricanes Katrina and Rita, and all sorts of disasters, the rainstorms in Guatemala. the tsunami, earthquake and tsunami in Asia. Now, of course, the earthquakes cannot be prevented, but the part of the destruction of the tsunami was because of resorts and things along the beaches on the Indian Ocean. Back to this report. There are 2.2 billion more mouths to feed than in 1972, and there will be another 2 billion in 30 years. Already 40% of the world is short of fresh water. In 30 years, this will rise to 50%. In West Asia, this rises to 90%. West Asia, of course, is where the U.S. has got its troops fighting for oil in Iraq and establishing bases in Central Asia, etc. At least 15% of the Earth's surface is already degraded by human activities. Overgrazing causes 35% of soil degradation, deforestation 30%, agriculture 27%. More than a billion urban dwellers, mostly in Africa, Asia, and Latin America, live in slums. Another billion people will be living in cities by 2010. Keep in mind here that if we have severe food shortages, which would be one of the effects of peak oil, because so much agriculture depends on oil for machinery and pesticides and fertilizers. How do people in the cities get fed? Because they depend on food being shipped in from outside the city. Half the world's rivers are seriously depleted and polluted. About 60% of the 227 biggest are disrupted by dams and other engineering works. We know all about that right here in Oregon. The Columbia and Snake Rivers have about half a dozen or more dams which stop the salmon. And one thing which isn't talked about very much with dams is all the soil that gets washed down the river, all the silt that kind of fills up behind the dams. How long are these dams even going to be operating when silt keeps filling up behind them? There are 4 billion cases of diarrhea causing 2.2 million deaths a year. And these are easily preventable. But they're not because the global economic system does not allow for it. 2 billion people are at risk from malaria and 2 million a year die. Contaminated shellfish causes an estimated 2.5 million death cases of infectious hepatitis annually, resulting in 25,000 deaths. We have a caller on the line. I'll just one more item, then we'll get to the caller. A fifth of the world's population is responsible for 90% of consumption. Two-thirds of the population, about 4 billion people, live on less than $2 a day. So that is this UN Global Outlook from actually 3 years ago. So let's get to our caller. Hi, you're on the air.
Well, hey, good morning. How are you doing?
Okay. Pretty good considering the bad news. How are you doing?
Yeah. You know, the one thing that really struck me about, this and other predictions I've heard is nobody's factoring in the loss of life that is probably going to be happening. You know, everybody's giving these projections that the population is going to keep growing and growing and growing.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, the other possibility and I dare say likelihood is really death. And there's just going to be a whole bunch of funerals in the next 20 years, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, with this whole thing of that bird flu thing everyone's freaking out about.
Mm-hmm.
I think that we all need to really talk about what are we going to do if people start dying left and right?
Well, you know, these kind of things happen. You go back to the so-called Black Death back in the 1400s. I think it was the 14th century, I believe. Anyway, mm-hmm. I think... I think about a third of the population in Europe were killed by the plague, you know.
Right. And the things that really lead to really disease are, well, population density.
Mm-hmm.
And population density obviously is another factor that really not only affects the quality of life, but it affects survival, not only from disease, but also enough food, going in, and of course finding a proper way to dispose of what comes out. And I think back to I was a biology major in college, and one of the things we learned was if you get a culture of bacteria and you start out with a certain volume of media, which would be like nutrient liquid, you introduce, you know, a drop of bacteria into maybe 5 liters of this nutrient material, and you could observe the growth in the population, and it would grow and grow and grow exponentially. At the whole time that it's growing, it's using resources, and then it's also excreting poison.
Mm-hmm.
And you get up to a point where you hit the plateau phase, where the population pretty much holds steady for a little bit, and then you get into the exponential decline phase. And I dare say that we're probably at the exponential decline phase. You know, everybody's been talking about overpopulation for, you know, since the 60s. And with the advent of petroleum, we've been able to put this off and off and off because we've been able to grow more and more and more food. But when the petroleum goes away, there's not going to be that input into our food stream, so we're going to have to go back to the old-fashioned organic way of growing food, which is probably less productive. And so I think it's just inevitable that a lot of people are going to either die from starvation or die from disease. And
well, it could be, you know, it's like the world in a petri dish, you know.
Yeah.
But, you know, Cuba actually faced this problem because about 10 years ago when the Soviet Union collapsed, Cuba stopped getting its cheap oil.
Right.
And so they had to totally revamp their agriculture, which they have done. And they have gone to a kind of organic agriculture. They have lots of little small mini farms in the cities.
Mm-hmm.
They have they've gone back to draft animals, you know, replacing the tractors. And so far, it has worked for Cuba. And in a way, in some ways, when you talk about production,
mm-hmm.
it's sort of, you know, it depends what the input is. American agriculture is great if the input is the number of farmers,
mm-hmm.
you see, because one farmer can feed, God, I don't know, who knows how many thousand people.
Right.
But if you talk about how much food you get from an acre of land,
mm-hmm.
It's not so great because...
oh, yeah, you're right.
So it's, you know, I think, there, you know, Cuba is, boy, showing us one way to deal with this.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. What do you think, Oregon? What do you think Portland will be like in... 20 or 30 years.
I really think that Portland, Oregon is one of the best places to be to weather this out.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we've got, I mean, really, we've got this really fertile Willamette Valley stretching to the south of us.
Mm-hmm.
And then just across the mountains, we've got kind of arid land, but if it's properly irrigated, it could totally, you know, feed us with truck crops. Is that what they call that?
Yeah.
Vegetables?
Well, you know, I was just over there this weekend. I kind of like the Bend and Sisters areas, different landscape entirely. And, you know, I was thinking about that as you drove around, is that you see a lot of cattle ranches or, you know, cows and sheep and llamas and things like that. It's pretty dry.
Mm-hmm.
I noticed there were a few along the highway. There were a couple farm stands. I meant to stop and ask them where they get their vegetables from because I didn't see any kind of farms that grow vegetables at all.
Mm-hmm.
Although I know up in Madras they grow a lot of mint.
Right.
So I don't know how that, you know, mint is a pretty hardy plant. It grows everywhere you don't want it to be. You know?
That and blackberry bushes.
Yeah, well, I suppose you could live off of blackberries.
Well, I hope not. I hope we don't have to. I
uh-huh.
guess, you know, I'm feeling that Portland has, you know, I mean, even though it's hard to imagine, we've got a pretty diverse, localized economy.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
And I think that's going to suit us well. We've got, on top of it, all of the progressive folks in town that have been... you know, paying attention to those internet conspiracy theories. I mean, we're pretty darn well educated.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that gives us a good jump up because when things do start getting bad and everybody else in the country is just figuring out that there's a problem, hopefully we will have recognized these problems long, long ago, and we'll have started coming up with solutions.
I think so. Well, thanks for your call.
Thank you.
Yeah, if we can't make it in Portland, I don't know where we can make it. I think we have another caller on the line. Hi, you're on the air.
Good morning, Per.
Good morning.
Thanks for your passion. Did you happen to see Kurt Vonnegut on the Now program on Friday?
No, I didn't. I don't watch a whole lot of TV, but it sounded like it was a pretty good show.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. He certainly woke up many people from their sleep. He spoke about the crucified earth,
mm-hmm.
the psychopathic president who doesn't care.
Oh, boy. Yeah, okay.
And who has emptied the treasury mm-hmm. instead of rebuilding schools and roads.
Mm-hmm.
He said, really, the game is over, that the planetary life support systems have really stopped or failed. To me, it's really vital, you know, to see distribution as the solution and not growth.
Right.
And to see consumption as the problem and not population.
Mm-hmm.
That we are very wasteful, that we've been caught in a consumerism and an accumulation lifestyle, and there are alternatives, sustainable economics and subsistence economics, learning from Cuba,
mm-hmm.
you know, learning from the poor, maybe learning from liberation theology that we live in a kairos time, not an everyday time,
mm-hmm.
that really we're faced with decisions, and we need to... you know, to challenge corporatocracy.
Well, you know, when you talk about subsistence level, you know, a lot of people think of that as just kind of living, you know, pretty far, pretty badly. But, you know, subsistence can be at a, you know, fairly decent level. Subsistence just means that you live on kind of what you grow or what your community can grow. And, you know, it's a sustainable thing. It's, you know, that you can go through, you know, the normal variations and stuff, but subsistence doesn't have to be really that poor.
Yes, actually, the poor are rich in song and festivity and community.
Hopefully, yeah. I just read a thing about it might have been the king of Bhutan. He wanted to replace the gross domestic product measure of, you know, well-being, which is just limited to goods and services, with a kind of a gross happiness index. And he spent a lot of time putting this together, and people are, you know, he started this about 10 years ago, and I think people are still taking, you know, they're beginning to take it seriously.
Yes, and there's mm-hmm. a group in San Francisco called Redefining Progress,
mm-hmm.
which has tried to work out alternatives to the gross national product. Because the gross national product counts traffic accidents, and
that's right,
cancer and nuclear mm-hmm. weapons as positive.
Well, sure, and you know, and right now you have all these economic gurus saying, "Hey, Katrina can be a big boost for the economy." You know, all the rebuilding that's going to go on, and blah blah blah. You know, all that.
It's very, very bizarre that, as Adbusters has emphasized, we have trouble seeing the negative, that economists must learn to subtract. You know, when we are so accustomed, I think, to repressing
mm-hmm.
anything that's uncomfortable, anything that's unpleasant.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. Okay. Hey, thanks for your call.
Thank you.
Okay. We got another caller on the line. Hi, you're on the air.
Please, Per.
Yes.
Please don't let anyone say that it's a matter as simple as redistribution. The human population is too great. I mean, the only redistribution that's going to take place is the migrations of masses of populations into seeking areas that are livable. But if anyone reads the literature, they'll see that there's unanimous a projection among the experts, the people who are the demographers of the future,
mm-hmm.
There's as big a consensus among them as there is a consensus among experts on global warming, that the human population on the surface of the earth is too great
mm-hmm.
The changes of severe changes of life that are going to take place after peak oil. I mean, the notion that we have enough resources and all we need is redistribution of them is factoring in the oil platform.
Well, I think redistributing resources would help. It's not, you know, like it's necessary but not sufficient, put it that way.
Come on, the United States is 5% of the world's population.
Right, okay.
Mm-hmm. And yes, the consumption here is, of course, I mean, the wealth we've known has simply been a product of having the only stable currency since World War II up until about 15 years ago, 10 years ago. So anyway, I mean, the point is we do have a staggeringly oversized human population, and unless the world comes to terms with that and mm-hmm. recognizing the need that even if we, no matter how severe are impositions to limit human populations, the consequences are just going to be staggering. I mean, anything we, the cities are the anomalies of history as they exist today. So anyway, just don't let anyone tell you it's just a simple matter of redistributing available resources. The resources aren't there. So, and they're diminishing. So thank you. Bye.
Well, actually, redistributing the world's resources would certainly mean that the U.S. consumes a lot less than other countries. The poor people of the world get to consume a little bit more. So, in that sense, redistributing is a good idea. Whether it's going to solve within this country. I mean, what do you redistribute? I mean, you can have. Do people need 2, 3, 4 homes that they travel around to? Do they need 3 cars? I mean, where do we start the redistributing? So, anyway, we have another caller. Let's get to them. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Pat.
Hi.
I guess I don't think we're going to have to worry about world population too much in the near future. The reason why is because if you notice that the PR machine is pumping out this thing about this avian flu, and of course it hasn't crossed from human to human yet, but they sure are predicting it, and I get highly suspicious when the machine comes out and says this is going to happen. When it hasn't happened yet, it's going to wipe out half the population of the earth.
Well, yeah, maybe yes, maybe not. It's I think they're pumping this up because George Bush wants to combat this with sort of a militarization strategy.
Well, wouldn't it be clever if they had some of course, not that it would ever do anything like this, but if they've already got the avian flu crossed, and then all they got to do is put in a few birds, and all of a sudden you got this roaring pandemic sweeping the world, and the people with the 250,000 vaccinations are the ones that are going to survive.
Well, you know, if you want to talk about, you know, if you want to go down that path, which I wouldn't rule it out. It would seem to me that the world's elites would create some virus that maybe targets people of color. So
yeah,
something like that.
Yeah, the lower class.
You know, rather than avian flu, which sort of targets everybody, of course, if you have, a couple hundred thousand vaccination shots, you give those to your friends and everything.
Well, I find it unusual. You know, I find it really unusual. You know, I unfortunately have ALL, and you sort of get the local, you know, the mainstream PR scheme that's going on. I find it unusual that a picture of George Bush, you know, meeting with the vaccination makers, you know, and this guy could care less about us. And it's like this constant barrage now of this pandemic that's going to sweep the world. And anytime these guys start talking about something like this, and it hasn't happened yet, you know, they got their finger in it.
Yeah, you know, it seems to me, I read a few years ago that one of these vaccine companies was owned by some pretty high-level military people.
Oh, yeah.
You know, retired officers.
Yeah, that's right. That was the vaccination for anthrax.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
They never solved that one either, did they?
No, they didn't either. So, hey, and you know what also, I don't know if you ever saw this thing, But and it made on the net a while, but never made the mainstream news that the protest at Washington D.C. They have I guess bio alert signals around Washington D.C. And what happened was some rabbit disease was released, which causes severe illnesses.
All right, I heard about that. Yes, yes. Well, maybe we can get into that later. Right now, I got one more caller on the line, and then we have our guest. So let's get our last call. Hi, you're on the air.
Yeah, my uterine senior problem is Ray Aldrin says, 1958, an overpopulation is like a train coming at us out of the night. Our resources are finite,
right,
but our demand will be infinite.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And one of the reasons for this is because corporations are so greedy that they can't stop using the market to enrich themselves. We're now with Brazil, 95% of the cars and bicycles in Rio de Janeiro ran on ethanol. But we had never used ethanol here except in the wintertime. And the reason is because the big oil companies don't want to see the price of the fuel go down.
Mm-hmm.
And they can't control it, and the agricultural interest would very likely be a formidable combination in the market that they could not control.
Yeah, well, you know, you see this thing about overproduction. At the beginning of every year, all the economic gurus look back and say, how did the holiday buying season, did it pump up the economy sufficiently, you know, as sort of like, but at the same time, on the other side of the mouth, they say Americans don't save enough. They don't save anything at all. They're going in the hock, you see. So you have this kind of a bipolar message here. You got to spend, but you have to save too. Well, we have our guest on the line, so thanks a lot for your call. Okay, I think we are talking with Richard Heinberg, who is the author of The Party's Over, and I think a more recent book, Power Down, which sort of tells us a little bit what we can do about peak oil. Richard, are you there?
Yes, good to be speaking with you.
Well, good morning. Welcome to KBOO.
Thank you.
Well, you know, I think unlike the Wall Street Journal, I think KBOO listeners are pretty aware of what peak oil is all about.
Yeah.
So we don't have to go into that too much, and we do have a peak oil group. They meet every Wednesday, and they have a meeting tonight, and they sort of focus a lot on what individuals can do. And so I'm wondering, in your book Power Down, you talk, well, there's the Power Down option. This is one of the four ways of dealing with peak oil. And the Power Down, of course, seems like the most, certainly the most enlightened. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, essentially, it has to do with nations of the world and communities finding ways to reduce our reliance on fossil fuels. And that's also going to have to entail finding ways to live with fewer energy inputs, because certainly over the short term, and probably over the long term too, we're not going to be able to find replacements for fossil fuels that will enable us to use energy at the rates that we've been accustomed to.
Mm-hmm.
So on the international level, that's going to require adopting something like an oil depletion protocol. And this is something that I'm really passionate about these days, because I think without an oil depletion protocol, everything else that we do may end up being useless, because if we don't find a way to reduce competition for remaining oil supplies globally, and therefore conflict over remaining oil supplies, I think we could find ourselves in a nuclear war.
Mm-hmm. Well,
for too long, and I think that would be the worst case scenario, but I think it's at this point it's not unlikely.
Well, of course, wars use up a lot of oil too. So.
That's true. Unfortunately, I think this would be a scenario that might not be survivable.
Mm-hmm.
So anything that we can do to avert that scenario, I think, is effort well spent. The oil depletion protocol would basically be an agreement whereby oil-producing nations would agree to produce less oil on a yearly basis, and oil-importing nations would agree to import less.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it sounds like a tough sell, but if you think of the alternative, not only war, but also global economic collapse because of very high and very volatile oil prices,
mm-hmm.
It's impossible for any corporation or community or nation to plan its economic future in the context of extremely volatile energy prices. We have to be able to make this energy transition, and in order to do that, we have to know what the future is going to be like. And the only way that's going to happen is if we have some way globally of rationing the remaining oil supplies and gradually weaning ourselves off of oil dependence.
Well, I understand the International Energy Agency has there's some kind of a treaty in effect right now, which the U.S. has signed on to, that in the event of some oil collapse or whatever, that there would be rationing.
Well, this is not an oil depletion protocol. It's mm-hmm. a suggestion for how to deal with oil shortages within mm-hmm. nations, mm-hmm. and that's important too. I think actually. We will need to adopt some kind of rationing scheme, and a good prototype for that has been developed by some British thinkers. It's called DTQs, or domestic tradable quotas, and you can find out more about that on the web at dtqs.org. Basically, the domestic tradable quotas are like ration coupons that
mm-hmm.
that folks can sell and trade, so that if you are handling your life in such a way that you don't use that much energy, you can trade your quotas or sell them and benefit thereby. Whereas if somebody still wants to drive their SUV, well, they can do it, but they'll have to pay through the nose. So I think actually in the end that's going to be a much better way of dealing with short fuel supplies than just letting the market take care of it. But on an international level, we need something more than that. We need an oil depletion protocol. And historically, we've had ways of rationing oil production previously, but that was in the context of too much supply. We had Standard Oil in the late 19th century, the Texas Railroad Commission from 1935 to 1970, and OPEC from 1970 to the present, all dealing with problem of too much oil by restricting oil production. In the future, we're going to need to deal with the problem of not enough oil by rationing supply.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the outlines of the way forward are there. We just need to publicize them, get them out to decision makers, and make the case.
So it becomes a kind of a political problem then. How do we get our leaders to go along with something like that?
Right. Well, I think in some countries it's going to be a fairly easy process. I'm thinking, for example, of a country like Venezuela.
Mm-hmm.
Venezuela can't continue to increase its oil output anyway. And Hugo Chavez is fond of making sort of grand political gestures, so I think it wouldn't be that difficult to talk him into making Venezuela the first nation in the world to adopt the oil depletion protocol. The two countries that will be most difficult to sign on will be the United States and China, and those will be the real deal breakers. But those will be the most important nations to have as part of the protocol agreement, because, of course, those are the two most important oil importing countries.
Well, actually, Chavez has been selling oil at cut rate prices to Caribbean nations, and he offered to provide oil to poor people in the U.S. after the hurricanes, and his land reform program is sort of the purpose of that is to allow Venezuelans to feed themselves when the oil does run out. So.
Right. Yeah, and for all of these reasons, I think he's the kind of person who might be interested in adopting the oil depletion protocol.
Mm-hmm. Well, earlier, you know, with listeners, and we talked about Cuba, how they dealt with their oil shortage after the Soviet Union collapsed.
Right.
And how they revamped their agricultural system, which is sort of should be a model for every country in the world.
That's right. Well, there's a lot that we can learn from Cuba. Cuba has some advantages in the sense of more tropical climate and a kind of command and control economy, which has some disadvantages too. I mean, I certainly have spoken to a lot of people who fled socialist countries because they couldn't stand that level of regimentation of the economy. But when it comes to a situation like peak oil, where you really need to redesign the economy very quickly, having that sort of command and control structure can actually help if the people in charge are able to make some good decisions.
Mm-hmm.
I think Cuba also had the advantage that they had some ecological agronomists who had some good ideas, and when the oil shortage happened, they could be brought in very quickly to make some suggestions, and a number of permaculturists made visits to Cuba very early on in the special period and recommended some permaculture solutions, which were enthusiastically adopted. So that's Cuba is kind of a best case scenario in terms of successful response to an oil famine.
Mm-hmm.
North Korea is sort of the other end of the spectrum. They went through the same energy famine, but unfortunately, there the aftermath included massive starvation.
Mm-hmm.
And they had some really bad luck there with floods and droughts that accompanied the.
I just read in the news today that North Korea, they're going to produce 7 million bicycles.
Well, good idea.
So that people can get around, you know, with the oil running out and everything.
I also heard this morning that in China, where last year they had banned bicycles on some city streets because they were getting in the way of the cars,
mm-hmm.
now some of the Chinese peasants are starting to attack cars because they're getting in the way of the bicycles.
Okay.
I think there's a little bit of a social revolution going on in China in regards to the automobile.
And a critical mass. Well, you know, you talked about kind of shining examples. There's one in Colombia. It's this town of Gaviotas. Have you heard about that?
Oh, yes. Yeah, I was in Colombia just a few weeks ago.
Did you get to see Gaviotas? Is it still there?
I wasn't able to go to Gaviotas. I was just in Bogota the whole time. I got out into the countryside a little bit, but not as far as Gaviotas. But there, Gaviotas has a center in Bogota where they teach their, you know, energy efficiency and permaculture style solutions. And I have to say the message isn't getting out all that far and fast, not nearly so much as it needs to, but at least that message is there, that example is there, and just about everybody in Colombia is aware of Gaviotas. And
mm-hmm.
I think when the crisis comes, at least they will have an example to turn to.
I wish people in this country were more aware. But one of the interesting things about Gaviotas is their economy is partly based on they found a tree that actually it's a tree that they imported from Nicaragua, but it grows very well where they are, and it produces a kind of a resin. It replaces these sort of industrial resins, you know, that are made from all kinds of stuff, with something that is kind of like a green solvent or it's non-toxic. It's a natural growth.
Yeah.
Well, I think we have a caller on the line. Let's go to them. Hi, you're on the air.
Hey, one of my friends who's pretty environmentally conscious hit me off to a website that brought up the theory that oil is not formed
mm-hmm.
through biological processes.
Oh, but yes.
Abiotically formed, and I was curious if you have any information on the relevance or truthfulness of that,
right?
And who might be putting that info out there?
Yeah. Well, you know, I'm not a geologist myself, but I over the last few years, as I've been writing about peak oil, I have met and talked to dozens of geologists. And I haven't found a single geologist who takes the abiotic theory seriously. Essentially, and I have a paper on this, by the way, on my website, museletter.com. That's M-U-S-E letter.com. If you search there for abiotic oil, you'll find the paper. The long and short of it is this. There is some evidence for abiotic formation of methane deep within the earth. And it's possible that some of that methane is making its way to the surface. However, the commercial oil deposits that we've found are all in sedimentary basins, and the explanation of the formation of that oil by biotic means is pretty airtight from a scientific standpoint. And so even if there is some abiotic formation of hydrocarbons going on, it's commercially insignificant. It's not going to make any difference at all as far as peak oil is concerned.
Seems to me more likely that we can get oil from things like industrial hemp and or alcohol from vegetation. I was reading recently that in England they're going to build a power plant, and it's going to be the fuel will be elephant grass.
Mm-hmm. Well, that will certainly be a better fuel stock than corn, which is what we're using in the Midwest of the United States to make ethanol with, which is... you know, the net energy gain using corn, even using the very optimistic USDA assessment, is only about 1.6 to 1. And I think that may be, you know, a little overly optimistic. But, you know, compared to what we've had with oil historically, that's almost insignificant. And I think we have to be careful with biofuels, too, and see them... ultimately as a fuel for emergency vehicles.
Mm-hmm.
Because if we get to the point where it's commercially more profitable for farmers or for companies like Archer Daniels Midland to take agricultural crops and turn them into fuel than it is to grow food for people, we could very easily have a situation not too far in the future where hundreds of millions of people are starving so that a million or two people can continue to drive their cars.
Right, right. You know, while these scientists can come up with some pretty strange ideas, I read of a thing called thermal depolymerization. Have you
right.
heard about that?
Yes, I have.
For our listeners, the idea is that a man weighing 175 pounds, if he was processed, assuming he's dead, would give you 3.8 pounds of oil, 7 pounds of gas, 7 pounds of mineral, and 123 pounds of clean water. So that's sort of... I don't know how many people are taking that idea seriously.
Well, there are two pilot plants operating, one in Carthage, Missouri, and the other one somewhere in the East Coast, I forget. I think it's in Pennsylvania, I'm not sure. I spoke with a chemical engineer who visited those pilot plants, and by the way, the thermal depolymerization, or TDP, has been written up in glowing terms in Discover magazine.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and... for a long time, I was getting, you know, two or three emails a day from people saying, oh, this is the solution to our energy problems. But I met a chemical engineer who visited both of those pilot plants, and he came back with the following news. Both of them are operating at a loss, and they're just drawing down government research grants. Second, they're an environmental nightmare. They both plants absolutely stink, and all of the neighbors are just up in arms, wanting to get these plants closed because horrific smells coming from them.
Like living next to Auschwitz.
Yeah,
or something.
And third, yes, you can feed any kind of organic material into a TDP process and get oil and methane out of them. But you have to design the plant for a specific waste stream. In other words, if you want to take turkey guts and turn it into oil, well, you have to design a plant just to take turkey guts.
Mm-hmm.
And then if you want to use plastic, then you have to design a separate plant for plastic. So it's, again, it's one of these ideas that sounds good when you first read it, but then you look at the reality, and it may help in the long run, but it's going to take a lot more research and a lot more investment before it's really able to
Yeah. Well, we got another caller. Let's get to them. Hi, you're on the air.
Good morning. Thank you. I read a book, which I've been separated from, called Matrix, A Biography of Water. Is your guest familiar with it?
No, I don't know that book.
The author's family name is Ball. There are two authors, actually. It's a fantastic book. And I think at the root of all of this, the solution for the perceived problem is water. It also points... There's so many facts that I won't even get to. I'm mainly calling to recommend this book to everyone, no matter what their experience in life is. But just one little fact. 65% of all the water for drinking is located in 10 countries. And I think if we look at political and military activities around the planet, we'll find that at the base of it all is the control of water. Thank you.
Okay, well.
Well, water is certainly essential for life, and I think the caller is correct that water is becoming a strategic, what would you say, element?
Yeah, well, you know, and unlike oil, water cannot be produced. It's just sort of, it's there. We,
right.
You know, the same amount of, all it can do, we can do it is degrade it.
Right. Yeah, of course, you can distill water from, you can desalinize water, but it takes energy. And so that leads us back to the energy question. I mean, you could debate what's more important, water or energy. You know, both are essential for life and for industrial society as we know it. I would argue that the folks in charge of U.S. foreign policy and strategic policy are probably more interested in energy than they are water right now. But
I think the first thing to do is we should stop using clean drinking water as a slurry to transport human waste. In other words, we should go to composting toilets.
Well, yes, of course. I mean, you know, if from an ecological point of view, that is a no-brainer. We have acted as though water is unlimited in quantity and extent, and of course, that's simply not true. And there are a lot of things like that we will absolutely have to change in the years ahead. And we'll look back on the 20th century and the early years of the 21st century and the way we've been living, guzzling energy and other resources, fresh water, and we'll just be appalled.
Yeah, they'll say, why did people poop in the drinking water?
Yeah.
Well, we got more callers. Let's get to one of them. Hi, you're on the air.
Hello?
Hello, you're on the air.
I heard a claim the other day. I think it was on the radio. It surprised me. I don't know how true it is, that the main foreign source of oil for the biggest import of oil from abroad comes from Canada to the United States. Do you know anything about the truthfulness of that? And if it is true, is it do they drill that much oil, or is it coming from their sands, or what? I heard they've got a lot of oil and sand up there.
Yeah, for many years recently, Canada has been a major supply of principal supplier of oil to the U.S. Canada has conventional oil wells, but those are drying up. Conventional oil production in Canada is on the steep decline, but the only source of oil that is on the increase in Canada is the tar sands, or what's sometimes called the oil sands in
Alberta. How much potential is there, do you know?
Well, there's a huge amount of resource in place, but the problem is it's not in a liquid form, so it requires, for its extraction and processing, it requires huge amounts of natural gas and fresh water. So the problem is not the amount of stuff that's there. The problem is the rate at which it can be extracted.
Okay, thank you.
And currently Canada's getting about 1 million barrels a day from the tar sands, maybe 2 million barrels a day by 2010, and just possibly with some technical breakthroughs, they might be able to get 4 million barrels a day by 2020.
Now, I understand that the tar sands is almost like asphalt, which makes me wonder, you know, in a future society, is there anything we can do with all this asphalt that we've got spread around? Or can that be recycled in any way at all? Do you know?
Well, sure, yeah. I mean, mm-hmm. you can dig up the streets and roadways all over the U.S. and mm-hmm. turn it into a little bit more oil. But then the question is, what's the oil for? If it's for cars, well, then you've just taken up all the roads that the cars would run on.
Right. Well, I don't know. But the thing is, would it require a lot of energy to even reprocess it? I mean, it's sort of...
Well, yeah. I mean, road building uses very heavy oil, high mm-hmm. sulfur oil that's too expensive to refine into other useful petroleum products. So mm-hmm. The stuff that we would be getting would be really literally the bottom of the barrel in terms of quality of,
right.
of fossil fuel.
Well, we got more callers. Hi, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hello.
That me?
That's you.
Okay. A lot of what you've been saying is yeah, right there, but the way I see the problem is that we have this inescapable trance with our resource base, that we have a group of people who are making decisions for the whole country that on the level of a child's view of property laws, if I want it, it's mine, and how much I take away from everybody else, and how much I destroy for everybody in the process of me having whatever I want, is of no consequence. And we have another group of people who have had so much for so long that they aren't paying attention and they're in denial, and they're willing to follow those people. And how do we break into that and remove the followers to the empowerment of the current government?
Well, I think the response to Hurricane Katrina shows that the federal government is really kind of useless. Maybe local guy. I was going to get to that with Richard Heinberg. What can our local governments do in the event of after peak oil?
Well, I think the time to start is right now. Mm-hmm. And one of the hopeful signs I'm seeing on the horizon is the fact that we're seeing quite a few municipal governments, well, quite a few. at least the process is beginning. Maybe half a dozen municipal governments around the country are starting to take peak oil seriously.
There's one in your neighborhood, Willits.
Willits, also Sebastopol in mm-hmm. Sonoma County here near where I live. I was invited by the city council of Bloomington, Indiana to come and give a talk there, and they're interested in starting a process of peak oil preparation there. Denver, Colorado is putting on a peak oil conference.
Mm-hmm.
City Council, actually the mayor of Denver, Colorado, is a former petroleum geologist who really gets it. And so Denver is putting on a peak oil conference in the next few weeks. And they'll be starting a process of planning and preparation. And there's a lot that can be done locally. Towns need to start by assessing their vulnerability. Things like they should be asking themselves questions like, where does their water come from?
Mm-hmm.
Not just the source of the water, but the energy that's required to pump water and purify water and then treat wastewater. If that's coming from just the regular power grid, then there's a vulnerability there, because usually the backup to that is diesel generators. Towns need to start looking at how they can make their water systems more energy self-reliant, and then looking at local food distribution and production. How can we make ourselves our food systems more resilient?
Mm-hmm.
And on and on. I mean, the list goes on, but all of this is really common sense stuff. We have to look at how vulnerable we are to disruptions in the supply system that's based on roads and trucks
mm-hmm.
and cars, and how we can possibility, setting up local car co-ops, car sharing systems, so that if prices become extremely high or if there are fuel shortages, we'll still be able to get people around to do the things that they absolutely need to do, go to their jobs and so on, but with much, much less gasoline and oil.
Mm-hmm.
We have to plan for these things ahead of time.
Right.
If we wait until the event occurs, we'll be much worse off.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the things we learned from Katrina. I mean, you know, there was a situation where people could see the potential for this kind of disaster years ahead. Everyone in New Orleans knew that the city was vulnerable, but not enough was done to prepare.
Right.
So we need to get this message clearly, and there are lots of tools. I mean,
mm-hmm.
Where you are in Portland, I think you need to be talking to your city council, and I don't know if you have a county board of supervisors.
Right, we have a county commission. We also have the metro government, which sort of includes three different counties.
Right, I would encourage everyone listening to this show right now to get in touch with those people,
mm-hmm.
and a good bit of ammunition you can use is the Hirsch Report. Go to www.thehirschreport.com, H-I-R-S-C-H.
Mm-hmm.
There's a government report paid for by the U.S. Department of Energy called Peaking of World Oil Production, Impacts, Mitigation, and Risk Management. And this report is written in the language that public officials understand, and it discusses the extreme vulnerability of our economy, our society, our entire way of life, to a global oil production peak, and it discusses how this is an inevitable occurrence and how we need to prepare for it
mm-hmm.
at least 10 years in advance.
Right.
Again, this is the kind of language that public officials understand. They need to be deluged with copies of the Hirsch Report until they sit down and read it and understand it.
Mm. Well, here in Portland, the Metro has, back in 1990, they did a 50-year plan. They called it the 2040 plan, and I've been thinking maybe they should revise that. It's not a bad plan.
Right.
A lot of light rail and then urban growth boundaries and things
yeah.
like that. But
Portland is way ahead of most American cities, and it has a lot to be proud of.
Mm-hmm. Let me tell our listeners what's coming up the rest of the morning. At 9, it's Movie Talk with reviews of the latest movies. 9:30, we'll hear the first of two lectures recently recorded. We hear David Cobb, the Green Party candidate for president in 2004, speaking at the recent National Summit to Save Our Elections, and he's speaking on lessons learned from the 2004 elections and the Ohio recount. Then we'll hear Buck Parker, environmental lawyer and director of Earth Justice, on Katrina, Global Warming, and the Endangered Species Act, moving an environmental agenda when the government won't. Now, People Rise Up will not be heard today. At 11 on Democracy Now!, an interview with Mary Wass on his new expose that Dick Cheney's aide Scooter Libby never told prosecutors that he spoke with New York Times reporter Judith Miller about CIA operative Valerie Plame. And human rights lawyer Jennifer Harberry talks about why Guatemalan villagers are refusing military aid in the mudslide there. Our listeners may recall that Jennifer Harberry was married to a Guatemalan man who was killed as a rebel, I think about 8 or 10 years ago. So those are things that are coming up. Rich, can you stay with us for a while longer?
Yeah, for a little while longer, yes.
About 15 minutes or so?
Sure.
Okay, great. I think we have another caller on the line. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. Good morning.
Good morning.
Mr. Heinberg.
Yes.
I work in the planning field. You know, I'm not quite a paid, you know, insider working in an agency, but I'm a citizen-level participant. I would like to get your opinion and some discussion and some questions answered about the hybrid vehicle technology.
Sure.
I feel that the hydrogen really is a mistake to be going, you know, expecting it to do what we, you know, all expectations as if it's going to be the next vehicle.
Sure.
And I say that the hybrid technology, because you use so many fuels, including hydrogen, you know, to burn, and the batteries, very important, these batteries that you can, you know, increase the size of in hybrid and create a home power system, you know, which could lead to real public power systems. If you've got a photovoltaic panel on your roof that you could charge it up and then drive a certain amount of miles, it's not unlimited, but when you can drive a limited number of miles or regularly, you will patronize local economies and thereby build your destinations so that ultimately you wouldn't have to drive to them. I just am dismayed that the hybrid car is being put aside for the hydrogen car in our, you know, national discussion about how we're going to live.
Right.
And I feel that the development of the local economies is unavoidable, that we will have to be going along in that direction in the future. So if you're following me, can you give me some feedback?
Sure. Well, I agree with you almost 100%.
Almost?
And I'll let you know the other 1%. But the 99% is that, the idea of waiting for hydrogen cars is, I can't say how wrong-headed that is. I think we do need more research in hydrogen, probably not for use in vehicles, but as an energy storage medium for other purposes. But it's hydrogen vehicles, even if they're a reality, are decades away.
Yeah, and I do not
and we
see
need,
them as a reality
we need something
at
much
all.
Sooner
I always
than
see
that,
the hybrid
oil technology. Production is not going to be peaking many decades from now. It's probably going to be peaking within the next few years. So we need short-term solutions, and
right.
we need the most efficient vehicles that we can get on the road as quickly as possible,
right.
which means not only hybrids, but probably diesel hybrids and plug-in hybrids.
Plug-in
you
hybrids,
get over 100 miles to the gallon. And if you let me just finish here.
Okay.
The 1% where I might maybe not even disagree, but just add to what you said, is that I think we need to move away from automobiles altogether.
Oh, well, of course.
Yes, we need more efficient automobiles, but ultimately the automobile is the least efficient form of transportation that we have. And we need to move in the direction of the most efficient form of transportation we have, which is the bicycle or the human-powered vehicle.
And mass transit. That's what I meant by the ability for the hybrid to, because of its limited range, build the local economies, whereby as we infill, you're able to walk to them and bike to them, and you can structure mass transit around them. So if we're going to be investing in the future car, and we've got the hybrid, which will outperform hydrogen in every way and more applicable to every vehicle size, then you can direct the development of your economies, your local economies, and the local can be served by walking and biking and structuring of mass transit. That's why I see, well, and that's not the only reason, but one of the main reasons why I see a hybrid as a threat to General Motors, let's say? A threat to
Enron? Yeah, well, unfortunately, the U.S. car companies had this technology years ago, and they did not develop it. Instead,
right.
they went the route of making more of the giant SUVs. And the Japanese developed the hybrids. The Europeans are way ahead in highly efficient diesel engines. And the U.S. car companies, I think, have not just shot themselves in the foot, they've shot themselves in the head.
I think
right.
they shot the country and the world in the brain by making us dependent upon long-distance travel and long-distance shipping and flying for everything.
That's right.
But is the book, The Party's Over?
That's, yes, The Party's Over. It's out in a brand-new, fully revised edition, about 20%
right.
new material.
Okay. Keep up the good work.
Yeah, thank you.
You bet.
Okay, I think we have another caller. Hi, you're on the air. Somebody there?
Hello,
you're on the air. Something is humming in the background. I don't know what it is. Have you got your radio on?
No, I don't. Yeah, no, I'm out in the sticks a ways.
Okay.
I just wondered if you give much thought to the possibility of increased freight rail traffic. Is there any room for more constructing more railroads? You know, I mean, one freight train can pull the same amount of freight as hundreds of semis pulling big
mm-hmm.
trailers.
Yes, and about five times the fuel efficiency.
Yeah. Could you talk about I mean, what's the political situation in the United States as far as increasing freight railroads, use of freight rail and passenger rail as far as that goes?
Yeah, well, we need to be moving more freight and people by rail and water and less by truck and car. And from an energetic standpoint, from an economic standpoint, it's absolutely clear. The only problem is political. That there is so much political clout from the trucking industry, the car industry, and the oil companies that they have determined political policy in this country, transportation policy for the last several decades.
Yeah, it seems very, very complicated. You've got you've got your Teamsters Union, you've got your railroad union. No matter what you do, somebody's ox gets gored. You know, I mean, if you increase freight rail usage dramatically, then a lot of truck drivers are going to be out of work. You know,
they're going to be out of work anyway. I think with the gas prices going up, and actually trucks can be loaded onto railroad cars anyway.
Right. Yeah, I mean, the sad thing is that we have allowed our rail infrastructure in this country to become dilapidated and dysfunctional. My colleague James Howard Kunstler has a good line about this. He says that the U.S. rail system would be the shame of Bulgaria.
Right, yeah.
And I think he's absolutely right about that.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, actually, I think rail's a lot easier to maintain than highways. Highways have to be really maintained at a very high level, or else they just kind of go all to hell, you know. And where rail can be, it's a lot easier to lay down and keep it running.
Yes. Yep.
Well, let's take another caller. Hi, you're on the air.
Good morning. Thanks for the show. Energy is such a huge problem. You probably devote a month worth of shows, but I think it boils down pretty much, and I would like your opinion on this, is that energy efficiency is probably the biggest, quickest thing we can do. And then there would be renewables, and then who knows what after that. Technologies that would sustain us into the future, battery technology, solar, wind, all the renewables.
Right.
I'd kind of like to remind Oregonians that we don't have any coal, any oil, or any gas. And hydropower plays just a fraction of what electricity we consume. As far as the hydrogen thing goes, I think that I agree with you. It's way off in the distance. It's just too expensive. And even the hybrid cars seem to be kind of, I see it maybe a little more simplified. Why not just have battery cars and then have fuel-driven cars rather than combining the two systems? Because I've seen examples of fuel-driven cars getting better mileage than the hybrid cars even. But we don't see them in this country, of course.
Right.
And also, other countries have battery-driven cars that are doing just fine. But, of course, they're not in this country. And our manufacturers have been yanking them and crushing them, basically, and other manufacturers. So,
right.
To me, it seems odd that the hybrid thing is so hyped.
Yeah, well, electric cars are a good idea, and In Europe, they're experimenting with compressed air cars, which is really just another form of electric car because they're using electric compressors to compress the air. And as I mentioned earlier, highly efficient diesel engines, the Volkswagen Lupo,
right,
for example, gets over 90 miles to the gallon.
Yeah, so why would you need a hybrid system with that?
Well, if you had a plug-in diesel hybrid, you could be getting over 200 miles to the gallon.
Oh, there you go. Well, there's also a lot of the direction automobiles have taken in the years. Weights have increased, drag coefficients have not decreased or as rapidly as the weights have increased. The amount of electronics on board is just, consumed more and more power and power, which comes from somewhere, of course, your gas tank. And so they're kind of off in the wrong direction for the most part.
Right.
It just doesn't make a whole lot of sense. I agree with people who, do a lot of bicycling. And I hear that in the other parts of the world, electrically assisted bicycles are a very large part of the transportation scene.
Yes, and those are extremely efficient vehicles.
Yeah, and we don't see them at all, hardly. And of course, we don't make a lot of room for our bicycles, in this country.
Yeah.
it's given short shrift. So, anyway, yeah, I appreciate your comments. Thank you very much.
Let me ask you one question. Are we talking about how, you know, the federal government really isn't doing much in this regard, and local governments are sort of where any solutions might lie? You know, it would seem to be over the long term, this would mean there's less need for a federal government. It would kind of be sort of a centrifugal force going on here.
Well, I think that is going to happen. It's going to be, as we have less energy available to maintain the economy, I think there's going to be less energy available to hold the center in place. And there will be more and more of a trend toward regionalism and toward localization of political control. And, ultimately, I think that's a very positive direction for events. But I don't think it's likely to be a really simple and easy process of devolution of political power. I think it's likely to be very messy and possibly violent in some cases.
Right.
So I'm not looking forward to that part of it. But
well, it may just happen whether they want it. Do you have time for one more call?
Sure.
Okay, let's take another call. Hi, you're on the air.
Is this me?
Yes, you.
All right. I appreciate the show. I read your book, Richard Heimberg.
Good.
And I had one question for you concerning another book I read called The Oil Factor. And in the book, the authors made the argument that they didn't think conservation would be a useful tool in the global sense of dealing with this problem unless a conservation regime was put in place across the world, so that if we are making better use of the remaining energy sources we have, but a voracious economy like China is not,
right,
then you get a wash. And I appreciate it. I'll take my response up here.
Sure. Yeah, that's why I think we need something like a global oil depletion protocol, which could get all the nations of the world on the same page of weaning themselves off of fossil fuels at the same time, at the same rate. If we have something like that, that will control prices, and it will make it possible for even the poorest countries to continue to afford to import the oil that they absolutely need in order to avoid total social collapse and economic collapse, while at the same time rebuilding their social and transportation and agricultural infrastructures to operate with renewable energy instead of fossil fuels. But if we don't have something like that, I think the leaves are right that if we don't have something like a global oil depletion protocol, then we're just going to have competition and conflict over the remaining supplies, and one country like China or the U.S. could really undermine energy efficiency efforts elsewhere in the world.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, boy, the calls keep coming in, but if you have to go, it's okay, but how do you feel about staying with us a while?
We could go to the top of the hour.
Top of the hour. Okay, that's when the program ends anyway. That's
okay,
great. Okay, we are talking with Richard Heinberg, the author of The Party's Over and Power Down, and we have another caller on the line. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Richard. Thanks for taking another call.
Sure.
I was wondering if you could address Amory Levin's pie in the sky idea for the hypercar,
right,
as well as another question, the possibility for solar-powered hydrogen fuel.
Right.
Yeah, I'll take my answers off the air.
Yeah, though I hesitate to say anything critical of Amory Levin's publicly, because he's done so much fine work in the field of energy efficiency. And at the same time, my concern is that he describes the possibilities of an energy transition away from fossil fuels as if it were a relatively easy process that could take place in the context of continued economic growth. And I question that. First of all, I think global oil production peak is likely to come far sooner than Amory Levin suggests. He thinks it's at least 20 years away. Well, if we have 20 years, good, but I sincerely doubt it. The signs that I see suggest that it may be here virtually right now, certainly within the next 5 or 7 years. And that does not give us enough time to make a smooth transition. So we're in a situation of really having to do some triage and figure out how to keep the lights burning, how to keep a modern economy going in the context of what will be, in effect, an energy famine. Now, hydrogen from solar, yes, great idea, but let's be realistic here. How much can we get from that source anytime soon? Currently, the total U.S. energy budget consists mostly of power from fossil fuels. About 80% of our energy is coming from fossil fuels. A little less than 9%, something like that, from nuclear. About 6% total from renewables. And of that 6%, only 1% of that is coming from solar energy. So we're looking at a natural gas crisis coming in this country because we're producing less natural gas. We're importing more from other countries, and it's hard to import natural gas from overseas. And we're using natural gas increasingly to generate electricity. Most of the new electrical generation capacity installed over the last few years has been natural gas-fired plants. That's a huge vulnerability. So to replace that natural gas generation capacity with renewables, like solar and wind, is going to be a gigantic job, and it's going to require immense investment. We'll have to work as hard as we possibly can to do that. Now, to think that we can grow renewables fast enough to make up for natural gas and at the same time have enough renewables left over to also generate hydrogen, I think, is a complete pipe dream.
Mm-hmm.
We have to be realistic here. We have to look at the scale of the problem and the time lag required to make the investment to produce the new technology and to get it running. And when you do, when you actually run those figures in any kind of real world scenario, we will be doing well just to keep the lights burning.
Right. In other words, the sustainable economy is about the best we can hope for, I guess. I think we have another caller on the line. Hi, you're on the air. Hello? Somebody on the line?
Yes. Hello. Can you hear me?
Sure. Okay.
Yeah. To the author, whose name, unfortunately, I don't have. If I were the king of the United States of North America, and I declared that all grave sites, mausoleums, all freeway entries and exits, you know, the traffic circles, those vast areas that have grass and stuff like that in them, and all buildings, newly constructed buildings, were required to have photovoltaic installations with the end purpose of solving or contributing greatly to the energy shortage. Would you laugh at that idea or consider it seriously?
Well, there's a lot that we can do with photovoltaics. We could be giving rebates to homeowners to put photovoltaics on their roofs. We could be putting them on public buildings. So there are all sorts of sites where we could be putting PV panels. PV is expensive. And right now, the world is not producing enough PV panels to meet demand. Yeah, it's a great idea, but again, we have to look at the practicalities of this. Right now, if you go to a shop and try to buy PV panels, they'll put you on a one-year waiting list.
Mm.
Maybe that's down by now. Maybe it's only 6 months, but currently the world supply is not able to meet demand. So what we need, first of all, are more PV companies and factories. So we could use some tax incentives for setting up new PV companies, producing them locally, I would suggest. How about some photovoltaics? And also, we shouldn't be thinking just in terms of photovoltaics, but also solar thermal, producing electricity from solar thermal, and also using solar thermal for home heating and
mm-hmm.
and so on.
Well, I know that's one contribution Amory Lovins has made. I think he heats his own home in the Rocky Mountains, and I think his heating costs about $50 a year or something.
Right.
Because he's got an efficient building, well-insulated, and so forth. Anyway, I think we have another caller on the line. Hi, you're on the air. Hello?
Hello?
Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, I'm sorry I missed most of this program, but I wanted your guest to respond to my question, which is, you know, there are all these wonderful ideas, and they've been around for a long time, different alternative energy sources and so on. But unless there's a political will, not much will happen. And, you know, there are other countries where essential services are controlled by the municipalities or the government, and the emphasis on individuals and how individuals can solve problems kind of gets in the way of that. So,
right.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good comment. And in fact, you know, the U.S. has done a lot of the basic research on renewable energy technologies, and yet the U.S. is lagging far behind countries like Germany and Spain and the Netherlands and Japan in the implementation of these renewable energy technologies. Which, you know, it's really a shame, and we should be doing much better. But the situation is that as global oil production peaks and begins its inevitable decline, we will pay the price for that. And so whatever time we have left, whether it's, you know, 6 months or 5 years, we desperately need to be getting our local governments and our national government on board with beginning this absolutely necessary energy transition. I think that actually the recent hurricanes, as awful as they were in terms of property damage and loss of human life, may actually help this process in a sense, because the damage to the pipeline infrastructure, the oil drilling rigs, the production platforms, and so on in the Gulf of Mexico are going to result in super high natural gas prices and probably rising gasoline prices in this country over the next few weeks and months, and hopefully that will get people's attention, and so that they can start to realize just how dependent we are on these resources and how we desperately need alternatives and how we need to be using these non-renewable resources much more efficiently as we wean ourselves off of them.
Yeah, I think, well, you know, like I said before, I think the Hurricane Katrina has showed how kind of useless the federal government has been. I don't know if it has to be that way, but, you know, I guess we have to start with our own communities, you know.
Right.
There's nothing that stops us from getting together with our neighbors and people, which is what the Peak Oil Group here is doing. They are meeting tonight at St. Francis Church. They were sort of into permaculture and all sorts of things. You know, we do have local officials. Some of them, I've talked to some of them, and they seem pretty willing to consider some of these things. So I guess that is where we start.
Yes, that's exactly where to start.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're getting close to the top of our hour here. What is the, give us your website again.
Yeah, that's newsletter.com, M-U-S-E.
Mm-hmm. Letter.com.
Right.
Okay, do you have any more books coming out? Is the latest...
No, I have a book on the oil depletion protocol that will be out hopefully early next summer.
Oh, okay.
And meanwhile, the new edition of The Party's Over is just out. It has all updated information, lots of new graphs and so on. So that's kind of the latest word at this point.
Okay, we've been talking with Richard Heinberg, the author of The Party's Over, both the old and the new editions, the author of Power Down, which gives us a good sort of idea of where we can go from here. And he has his website, Muse, M-U-S-E, as in what poets listen to, letter.com. Thank you very much for being with us.
Sure. It's been a pleasure talking with you.
Okay. Hope we can do it again sometime. We may have to, the way this thing is going.
Okay.
Okay. Thanks a lot. Richard Heinberg.